Thank you so much. It really is a pleasure to be here. And thanks for inviting me here. I would like to particularly thank Professor Rao for being an extremely kind host. I am certainly indebted to him and many other people in the room, but particularly Professor Rao, for taking care of every single practical, from the smallest to the biggest problems. I mean, he was just there to help me, so thank you very much. The topic for today is Gamma Ray Burst, and I know that the audience is mixed in the sense that not all of you work on gamma ray burst. And so the attempt here is to provide an overview of the subject of gamma ray burst, starting with very brief introduction for the purpose of graduate students. And I see a number of you who are likely to be, who look like graduate students. And then I would move on and give you a broad overview of the subject. The subject has grown quite a lot, and therefore it is really not possible even to give you a fair and a balanced overview of the entire subject. So I have to still pick and choose, but the attempt is to try to at least give you a flavor of things, the most important things that we have learned, and the open questions. What are the open questions? So that's the attempt. Most of the talk is not technical and should be accessible to all of you. The technical part, I would be happy to discuss at any point during the talk. You can ask, raise your hand and say that you would like to understand the technical part, and I would be happy to provide the technical derivations here on board. You can ask me on Friday, that is not a lecture on Friday. The purpose of that is to go over any questions that you might have, including technical ones. And last thing, and then I would get going, is that some of the technical aspects of the gamma ray physics and will be discussed in Pune. I know only some very small fraction of you will be in Pune, but those slides, if you are interested, can be certainly made from my point of view available to anyone interested in that. With that, let me give a very, very brief history of the discovery of gamma ray burst. The discovery was completely accidental discovery. The purpose of this particular satellite called Vela, it was launched in 1967. There were a series of satellites, altogether six satellites launched in 67, 69, and 70, with the sole purpose of making sure that the former Soviet Union is complying with a treaty that was signed by between the Soviet Union, United States, and a number of European countries, banning nuclear test in the atmosphere. And one of the ways that you can monitor nuclear test is look for gamma ray flash accompanying nuclear test. That was the purpose of these satellites. And with that, launch, there was this discovery of indeed gamma ray flash, but not coming from anywhere on the Earth, but coming from outer space. That discovery was announced in 73. It was published, it was discovered in 67, published in 73, and then for a period of about 25 years, people had no idea about something real basic as to where they are. What's the distance to these objects? So I will fast forward from that initial detection and fast forward to 91. That was the first important step and clue to unraveling the mystery of gamma ray burst. And what happened in 91 was there was this satellite called Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, CGRO, that was launched by NASA. And what the satellite established very quickly within a year of the launch is that these explosions are distributed in the sky, which is completely isotropic, and moreover, non-Euclidean space distribution. The two together convinced many people, I would say a large fraction of the community, astrophysics community, was convinced that these explosions are not coming from within our galaxy, but they are coming from distances far, far larger than the size of our galaxy. I see two questions, so please go ahead in the back.
Yeah. What is non-Euclidean
space distribution? What do you mean by that? By non-Euclidean space distribution, what it means is this, that you are making what we measure, what the satellites measure, is the flux of the burst. And what you do is you do a number count. You ask, how many bursts have flux is smaller than a certain value f, and that n is smaller than f. If there is a chalk, I don't know if you can see it, I will try it if, thank you. So the relationship is n less than f. F is the observed flux. That's proportional to f minus 3/2. This is a result that you can show is valid result for a Euclidean space. Yeah? It was found to deviate from this particular relationship, non-Euclidean, and those two together, isotropy and non-Euclidean behavior, was taken together to mean that these things are coming from distances much, much larger than the size of our galaxy.
Okay, this relating to red.
Yes.
If you had red shift, yes, and obtained, it is a different matter. Here, the assumption going is the gamma ray burst at short distance and long distance. They have similar kind of thing. If there is an evolution.
There is an evolution. That's very true. You are very right.
So in that sense, you cannot distinguish between evolution and non-Euclidean.
That's a
departure from this.
That's a good point. Completely valid point. You cannot. So the space could be Euclidean, meaning the distribution could be Euclidean, but evolving. But the point is that if it is evolving, it means that the only correct time scale is the Hubble time. Yeah, it is difficult to imagine things evolving on a time scale much, much smaller than the Hubble time. Yeah, therefore it is also, so what you say is absolutely correct, but that is also another way of saying the same thing, that these things are far away. Yeah.
So, make two points.
Absolutely.
One is that this isotropy and non-Euclidean space were known even before competency GRO during the Venera experiments of the then Soviet Union. So that means that the log n log t goes beyond minus 33 but and flattens. This is number one point.
Yes.
And this information that number density flattens was explained by a extended halo in our own galaxy. In
that's sense, true.
And then it's completely valid that the deviation of minus 3 by 2 will be far away from the galaxy, but could be commensurate with the extended halo in our own galaxy.
Very, very, that's very, very true. That was indeed a case. That is why these things were indication that these are cosmological, but very far from the proof. So this is, as I say, is the first step in the direction toward establishing what they might be. And now we are going to, again, this was fast forwarding from 67 to 92. I'm going to fast forward even more. And we come to so the next step here, which did establish the redshift, was the launch of this European Dutch-Italian satellite, BepoSax, that was launched in 97. The first discovery that was made was in early 97. And that was quickly followed by measurement of an afterglow. It's like a cooling ember. What happened is this, that the localization provided, the space localization provided by BepoSax was 5 arc minute, a 20-fold increase in the localization of these bursts. And that makes a huge difference. 20-fold increase means previously position to these gamma ray bursts were known to within a few degree, and now you have got 5 arc minute, 2 degree is just very difficult for certainly any good respectable size telescope to search such a wide area of the sky. That was not possible, was not done. With 5 arc minute, people could search, and very quickly they found a fading optical afterglow associated with the gamma ray burst. Once you have optical measurement, then clearly you can do the standard things that astronomers do, take a spectrum, make a measurement of redshift, and so on. And that established that these, at least one of the objects detected in 97 in January, that was definitely at cosmological distances, redshift of order unity. And that consequence of that is immediately clear from the known flux and the duration. You know that the energy released in these explosions is large, something on the order of 10 to the power 53, if you assume that the explosion is isotropic. And I will come to the fact that these are not isotropic. They are highly non-isotropic. But if they were isotropic, that's the amount of energy release associated with them. This is incidentally slide number 4. The slides are numbered, I'm afraid, in somewhat smaller font, but here at the bottom right corner, you will see the slide number. The next step was that not only that we know the redshift, but for one of the bursts, the first one, this occurred in 2003, March 29th, that's the nomenclature. The numbering is based on that nomenclature. So for this particular burst, the spectrum was, not only that the spectrum was taken, but it was found to be similar to supernova spectrum. And the two are compared here in this slide. What you are looking at is the solid line is the spectrum of the gamma ray burst optical part during the afterglow phase. That is to say, long after the gamma ray emission has ceased, has ended. And what you see as the dotted line is a comparison of this with a supernova spectrum. But a particularly energetic supernova of a certain type called 1C type. And you can see for yourself the similarity. These different spectra that you see are spectra taken at different times. And those times are indicated here. 4 days after the gamma ray trigger or gamma ray burst and so on. Down here at this bottom, about 27 days. And there is a very nice comparison. What you're looking at is emission lines of carbon 2, oxygen 2, etc. And so there is a good match. And in a sense, that's the smoking gun that you are looking at these two very different kind of a phenomena, gamma ray burst and supernovae, which are connected, i.e. that they are both originating in the collapse of a massive star. I should point out, before I talk about this particular slide, I should point out one very basic thing, which is the following. That gamma ray burst in the gamma ray band lasts for anywhere from a fraction of a second to nowadays, we have seen bursts lasting for about 1,000 seconds. And astronomers classify bursts into two classes. Short duration burst that lasts for less than 2 seconds, and long duration gamma ray burst that lasts for more than 2 seconds. These bursts, which are originating from the collapse of a massive stars, produce long duration burst.
Just a small question.
Please, absolutely.
The two are always associated, meaning whenever there is a GRB, there is a supernova associated, and other way around. For large numbers.
It's a very good question. And let me address that right away. I would also come to it. But no. Let me address it right away. The answer is no. Only a very small fraction of supernovae give rise to gamma ray burst, and that fraction is about 1%. only one person. So it's an unusual channel of collapse giving rise to gamma ray burst. Now, the other, you asked me a question going in both directions. Let me answer the question in the other direction as well. Do we see a supernova associated with all long duration gamma ray burst? Answer is, we do not. And that could be an observational selection effect. So there, the answer is less clear cut. The first answer that I gave you is completely clear cut.
Gamma ray burst extremely highly beamed.
Yes.
So even if all supernova produce gamma ray burst, there could be orphan gamma ray burst. How is it counteracted?
People have looked for orphan gamma ray burst. And the way one can look for orphan gamma ray burst is that as this outflow is slowing down and becoming sub-relativistic, it also expands. Not only that, even if it were not to expand, the relativistic beaming becomes weaker and weaker and weaker, so that the photons are no longer beamed in a narrow cone, but they would be seen from anywhere.
Are there any orphan afterglow seen?
There is not a single case, not a single case which is universally believed. So there are claims of seeing orphan afterglow, but not universally agreed upon. So we have limits.
If I advocate saying that,
yes,
some of the supernova may be have highly beamed, maybe orphan afterglow you don't see, so 1% could be higher percent.
Could be, but there is some room there, but not a whole lot. The reason is, I will give you, these are all excellent questions. So the reason is the following. People have looked for this bright supernova, rather energetic supernovae of this particular class of 1C class. And they have taken a census of that and they followed it over time to see if there is any evidence that these are producing gamma ray bursts, which may be beamed in a different direction. So this number of, so if you do that, it goes up to about 3 to 4%. So it seems like it's difficult to get around. So not 1%, but 3 to 4% may be the fraction. This particular slide, what I wanted to share and point out about this particular thing here is that gamma ray bursts really are intrinsically very different from your garden variety supernovae in the following sense. The speed at which the material that is ejected in these explosions is moving very, very close to the speed of light. As opposed to supernovae, of at least a garden variety supernovae, where things are moving at a speed which is about 1% of the speed of light, roughly 1 to 2% of the speed of light. Here, the speed is 99.999% of the speed of light. So please keep in mind that huge big difference between these two different phenomena. And the underlying physics is also likely to be very, very different. Okay? That's the point that I will come back and keep emphasizing and try to explain what the differences may be. But overall, there is a huge big difference. This particular, there are many, many lines of observations and theoretical argument supporting what I told you about gamma ray burst ejecta speed. This is one of the best that I'm sharing with you. And that is the following. In this particular burst, this is the same one that I showed you the spectrum for in the previous slide. Yeah. For this was near enough in the terms of the distance that it could be imaged using VLBI. So with VLBI observation, you could make a measurement of the angular size, angular diameter of this object over a period of time. And what was found is that its size is increasing with time. Yeah? And that's what is shown here. So on the x-axis, this is time in days. You see no measurement at about 10 days, only upper limits. But then there is an actual measurement. This is the angular size in micro arc second, something on the order of, you can read for yourself, about 70 micro arc second here at about 25 days. Yeah, that's the size of this object, okay, this ejecta.
Is it the size of the ejecta or size of supernova?
No, it's the size of the ejecta. It's the remnant. That's the size of that remnant.
Supernova remnant.
Correct. Meaning, or GR, to be precise, GRB remnant. Okay. It is a remnant of the gamma ray burst. That size is that. Yeah. But now, when you look at it, the observers looked at it at about 80 days. Yeah. You see the size has increased. Yeah. That size has become from 70 micro arc second to almost 200 micro arc second. We know the redshift, so we know the distance to the object. From the size, we can make a measurement of the speed at which this is expanding. That's the straightforward thing to do. And what you find is the expansion speed you can calculate here is order of 5c, 5 times the speed of light. Now, don't get alarmed. Those of you who don't deal with this thing, do not be alarmed. It's not violating any law of physics. It's certainly not violating special relativity or any such thing. It is simply an artifact of the following, that if an object is moving at a speed which is close to the speed of light and is coming toward you, then the apparent speed, the speed at which you will see it expanding in the sky, can be arbitrarily large. Okay? And that's what you're looking at. So from here, it's a straightforward thing to do is to determine the true speed of the expansion of this ejecta, and that was found to correspond to the Lorentz factor of 7. This is 25 days after the explosion. So 25 days after the explosion, this thing was moving with a Lorentz factor of 7. It slowed down somewhat. It's continuously slowing down. You extrapolate it backward in time to the time of the gamma ray burst, which is few seconds, and what you find is that the Lorentz factor of the ejecta was something on the order of few hundred. Okay. Yes?
Is it the apparent velocity or the speed when the ejecta is coming towards you?
Correct.
Is that in the same light, whatever expansion velocity?
It is certainly the apparent speed. I'm sorry, I didn't catch the second part of what you were saying. It is expanding, yes. So it is expanding. Think of it this in the simplest picture, the simplest way I can communicate to you the picture is the following. Think of a explosion, yeah? That fireball is expanding, yeah? And you are making a measurement of how big the fireball is at different times. Yeah, so the radius of it. Yeah. So, to the lowest order, it is the same. Dotted versus dashed curves are three different models, three different theoretical models based on the density of the medium in the vicinity of the gamma ray burst. Yes.
So does the fact that it is slowing down?
Yes.
From gamma equal to 7 to something less later.
Correct. And it was higher at earlier time. Please go ahead.
It tells you something about the circumcellular.
Absolutely, it does. I will come to that very shortly. Absolutely.
50 micro arc second.
Yes.
Does it correspond to the size of the fireball after 20 days?
Or it does.
Does it correspond to the whole supernova size?
So the supernova, I should make that distinction. The supernova associated with this thing is likely to be nearly spherically symmetric. The GRB is beamed, quite beamed. So they are two separate things. What is being looked at here is the gamma ray burst, which is not the spherical part. And that's why I was hesitant in answering your question regarding is the motion along the line of sight is the same thing as the transverse motion. If you sense the slight hesitation on my part, it was because of that caveat. It was because of that. Okay? So. I'm just going to go over, give you a quick kind of a summary of what's going on. And that is, stars are born in molecular clouds, and due to gravitational, they undergo, gravitational contraction, and stay on the main sequence, which is where they spend most of their time. Massive stars typically live for about 10 million years. then they go through this stage quickly of supergiant, become supergiant, lose mass, and then they die most of the time in the form of supernova, giving rise to supernova. I'm just going to see if that. And there is a rare channel, and that rare channel is that they produce a gamma ray burst, which is that the core collapses either to a black hole or to a neutron star, which is rapidly rotating and endowed with a very strong magnetic field called magnetar. So that rare channel is almost certainly responsible for the gamma ray burst. It's unlikely that a typical supernova, which is this thing here, is powered by the formation of a black hole or by this millisecond. For that reason.
I agree.
But you mentioned earlier in your compared type 1c supernova, though it is massive star, there the question of mass loss and things are different from.
They probably all lose mass.
Yes,
one, go ahead, complete what? Your thought. They all lose mass, all massive stars lose mass. One thing is required and is necessary. I'm afraid I would not have the time to go into that here in this talk. I'm giving a talk, I'm afraid that is just the way things are in Pune, on the whole topic of the progenitor stars and their property, where I would discuss, and the slides, as I say, would be made available to you, where I would describe the differences between, you know, supernovae and gamma ray burst in more detail, the progenitor star and what it takes. Let me just give you at least an answer here, brief one, and that is you do need the star to be rapidly rotating. That's a requirement to the best of our knowledge to produce a gamma ray burst.
So that kind of rapidly rotating star requires you to have collision between stars, or you can also have collapse in analogous
medium. So it can, there could be a number of different possibilities for rapid rotation. One is prevent the mass loss, because mass loss, accompanying mass loss is angular momentum loss. And therefore, if you can prevent a star from losing mass, then you can keep its original angular momentum. And young stars are born with, well, rapidly rotating, large angular momentum, yeah? So if you can prevent the mass loss, that's one way that you can ensure that when it collapses, it will have large angular momentum, and it could form, even if it forms a black hole, there would be accretion disk. If it collapses to a neutron star, then it would be a rapidly rotating neutron star like a magnetar. Yeah? So that's one way, but that's not the only way. You could also have a system which is in a binary system where need not be merger is not required, but tidally you can spin it up. As long as they are close binary system, so the tidal forces can keep it synchronized. That's another way. But there are other possibilities too.
For massive stars, from simulation, we have a certain idea how many will form black holes. So you are contending that GRBs are even still rarer than the formation of black holes. That's one more thing is required.
Very, very true. Very true.
What will be the period of the resulting black hole after?
What is the?
Will that be also be
with a parameter? Would be order unity. And when I say order unity, I don't mean half. It will be very close to one.
So we expect that all black holes that will come out of gamma ray burst will have the order of unity, the Carnot meter.
That is correct. That is what is expected. But keep in mind, we do not have any direct observational measurement for it. So that I'm now, what I'm telling you is based on our theoretical expectation. The theoretical basis for this expectation comes from the ability to launch jet, powerful jet. And that seems, based on our best simulations, current understanding of the launching of the jet, that it requires rapidly spinning black hole. So,
can I
Oh, yes. Well, we know it's one or the other. We know that it cannot be anything else. And there is a very, very, I would say, compelling argument. And again, I'm hesitant. I'm aware of the time. And you have to decide collectively. I'm happy to answer all of these things and go into detail and tell you why it is one or the other, how we can tell them apart. So you have to kind of, so you will just have to maybe make a decision on behalf of the audience and tell me what, which direction would you like me to go. I'm happy. I mean, these are good questions. This outflow, which is produced in these explosions, moving at a Lorentz factor of 100 or a few hundred, is moving into the surrounding medium. And as it is moving into the surrounding medium, it slows down. It is sweeping up the interstellar or circumstellar medium, and it drives a strong shock wave into the medium, and that strong shock wave accelerates electrons and protons. And these electrons, which are accelerated, then produce synchrotron radiation. There is magnetic field present. Magnetic field, even if it were not to be present, it would be generated in shocks. So all the radiation we receive after the end of the gamma ray phase, lasting for less than a minute, all of that is produced by this mechanism of shock going into the surrounding medium. And that produces X-rays, optical, millimeter, radio, lasting for duration of anywhere from hours to days to, in some cases, in the radio band, years, but it's fading, like the amber, like a cooling down amber, which you will see shortly in this slide. What you have here is a number of different gamma ray bursts, and you are looking at the light curve in the radio band, optical band, and the X-ray band. And these are on the time scale of 1/10 of a day, roughly, so a couple of hours, lasting in some cases to hundreds of days. And the lines that you see are theoretical fix based on this model I described, shock going into the circumstellar medium and synchrotron radiation. And to what I want to draw your attention to is the fact that there is a good fit. The data and the theory are in good agreement. And that's a work done in, this particular work was done in 2001, long time ago. That's how we figured out things like what's the total amount of energy release, how beam these objects are, how non-spherically symmetric these objects are. We could make a measurement of the angle over which the energy is coming out or the ejecta is beamed, and that angle turns out to be a few degree typically. And the energy, the total energy involved is something on the order of 10 to the 51 erg. The next step in this gamma ray story is the launch of Swift satellite, 2004. And another satellite, the Integral, 2002. What it did, what Swift did, what was the major accomplishment of Swift was the following, that BepoSats had a gap from the detection of the gamma ray to doing a follow-up in the optical or X-ray, actually X-ray, there was a gap of several hours. That gap was filled by Swift. Swift had instruments which would detect gamma ray, and then the whole spacecraft will slew rapidly on time scale of 60 seconds or less, and point the X-ray telescope, and make a continuous observation of this whole emission in the X-ray to optical UV. And what it discovered was that after the gamma ray phase, lasting for, in this particular case, about 10 seconds or 15 seconds, there was a very rapidly declining X-ray flux, followed by a plateau and then the normal decline. This is the part that was seen by Bapusacks. These are the parts that were seen by Bapusacks. So it provided, it filled in this gap of several hours, and it made all these, certainly the community was taken by surprise by all these discoveries.
Yes. So all this fitting can be done, you can measure the parameters.
Correct.
So similar fitting can be done for the early X-ray and optical, which is shown in the later on?
The later on, it becomes much more difficult. It turns out that part of it can be done. And
these are not model fit.
Sorry. Let me go back.
This is not model fit.
There is no model fit here. No. There is no model fit here. No model fit is done. And it turns out to be uncertain, very uncertain and unknown. Parts of it can be understood. This particular rapidly declining, it turns out that I had predicted this behavior in 2000, and it is not I who say that. Swift detected this particular behavior, and the Swift team realized that this particular very unexpected behavior was something that was predicted several years ago by me and my postdoc, Alin Panitescu. And that's the model that is used to explain this particular rapid declining phase. And there's a whole lot of things associated with that. Plateau is a different story. And if I have time, I will tell you a little bit about it. But that story, again, will be told more in Pune, not here.
How universal is these phases?
This universal, common, not universal, which is to say, the rapid decline is seen very, very often, not 100% of the time, but most of the time, something on the order of maybe 80-90% of the time you see that behavior. The plateau is less frequent, but something on the order of 50% of the cases, you see the plateau. So fairly common. But there is another remarkable thing about it. You see the plateau in the X-ray band, but this one here is the optical data. No hint of plateau, none at all.
And the optical behavior is completely different in the bottom one.
And the bottom one you can see, yes, exactly right. Completely different. Very true.
So this, if the rapid decline phase, it is associated to the high latitude effect.
That is what,
so
yeah.
If it is not present, what does it imply for GRB?
If that is not, it is, as I say, it is present most of the time. And I'm trying to think of a case where it is not really present. And what it would imply is the following, that afterglow takes over so that there is never this particular phase there. I.e., another way of saying that is that afterglow starts out being very bright and it simply just takes over, even maybe during the gamma ray burst itself. So. It's a good thought there should be a relationship like that, but it turns out more complicated than that. It's not the density alone that determines it. It is a number of other parameters. The strength of magnetic field is very important in the shock because this is synchrotron radiation. Therefore, it depends on the magnetic field strength. And so there are a number of other things that prevent us from being able to say that it is a consequence of what you suggest. So the suggestion is good, turns out not to be correct, not to be necessarily correct. So.
Do we see any kind of lag between different frequencies in optical or maybe?
Do we see a lag? Look, when you are seeing features which are present in X-ray and not in optical, we can't talk about lag. See, you can only talk about lag when you are seeing similar features in two different frequency bands, okay? And therefore, I'm afraid that question is, I'm afraid, not meaningful in this particular case.
And this is actually detected.
This was not possible in the prior to Swift because of this gap of 7 hours. Or 6 hours, or 5 hours. This is all happening. Yes. If your question is whether can it, has it been done? Yes, it's not 100%. It's no, there's no instrumental bias. So. If the sense of your question is if there is an instrumental bias, answer is no, because associated with every single gamma ray emission, almost every single, which means it may be something on the order of 99%, you see X-ray. So not a selection effect. Optical, there is a selection effect, because only half of the cases you see optical. So
no, I mean, there is, of course that is true, but
yes.
Slew.
Oh, slewing is very fast. As I say, slewing is 60 seconds or less. Not an issue. So,
but you're talking about tens of seconds.
Tens of seconds. So there could be a gap. These things are lasting for 10 seconds. So yeah, could there be a gap? Yeah, there is a gap. Oftentimes there is a gap. But the gap now we are talking about is a gap of few tens of seconds. No longer we are talking about gap of minute or larger. So is that make sense? Yeah? So not a selection effect of the kind that you're thinking about. What time am I supposed to stop? No, I'm happy to be you. No, but the tradition is that should I end at 4:55, 5 o'clock?
It's already
4:15. Okay, I just don't want to kind of ruin your whole tradition. So, is it still okay? Look, I can always select things that I, you know, feel that I want to share and convey to you. So 10,
half an hour from now.
Okay, no, I will stick with, look, I know very well the following thing, that hour is a good time, it's a good quantum of time, and after that, you lose people. Okay, so what I will do is that, again, now I'm going to pick and choose, and only tell you things that I feel are particularly worthy of drawing your attention to it, okay? So another discovery that the Swift made was that it also saw flares. Now that means nothing. These are X-ray flares. What it means is the following. Prior to Swift, people thought that the central engine, the accreting black hole, the magnetar, is active for a time scale of 10 seconds, 20 seconds, 30 seconds, and then the engine shuts down. What Swift discovered is not true. The engine comes back to life from dead. A dead engine coming back to life on time scales of anywhere from minutes to hours to days. And that's what I'm sharing here and drawing your attention to. What you are seeing here are these rapid, huge amplitude flares, meaning sudden increase in the X-ray flux by orders of magnitude. And that happens randomly. So that tells us about the property of this object sitting at the center of the explosion. Mostly I'm going to skip, only draw attention to something here very, very briefly. Swift has seen GRBs out to a redshift of record holder is 9.4. So that's one of the certainly highest known object in the universe. And GRBs, the point of sharing that with you is to emphasize that that is the frontier that will open up, it's just a matter of time, of the high redshift universe, the formation of the very first stars, the population 3 stars. The only way we are going to be able to study the population 3 stars and the formation of the first object is gamma ray burst. And this is simply a proof of the concept that we can see GRBs out to a redshift of 9.4. And Swift, in principle, should be able to see bursts of this kind up to a redshift of 15. This particular burst that I'm sharing here, showing you here, is a typical long duration gamma ray burst. Nothing unusual about it, not brightness, not any property. Okay? This one here is only reason for showing this thing is you may have seen this thing flicker, or maybe not. If it does, it does. Never mind, let's just move on. You see it flicker. This is a burst at a redshift of 1 that could have been seen with unaided eye, no telescope in the optical band, for a short duration of about half a minute. Just think about that. This was brighter than the brightest supernova by a factor of about 3 million times brighter than the brightest supernova. So I'm just trying to give you, convey to you, those of you who do not work in this particular field, I'm just trying to give you an overview of what we are dealing with here. This point, the only point of this particular slide is to share with you that GRB is the way that we are going to be able to study the universe at a high redshift of 10, 15, possibly larger, when the very, very first stars were forming. I have already mentioned these two different possibilities, and I'm just not going to say anything more about it. These are the two possibilities for supplying energy to gamma ray burst: a black hole formed in the collapse of the star, and an accretion onto the black hole, or a rapidly rotating neutron star with a strong magnetic field of something on the order of 10 to the power 15 to 16 Gauss, which is 3 to 4 orders of magnitude larger magnetic field than a typical pulsar, radio pulsar. Why that is the case, you can always ask me, and so on. Again, I'm just going to have to just move on. There are a number of questions which are unanswered about GRB. So let's just try to focus in the limited time that we have got, things that we do not understand. I have mentioned this already about this being a rare channel. The other thing we do not know about this relativistic outflow producing gamma ray burst is the composition of this outflow, the jet that is coming out. Is it a baryonic jet? Is it electrons and positrons? Is it magnetic field, meaning pointing outflow? We do not have an answer to that. And in the talk on Thursday, I will talk about completely different topic, where stars fall into supermassive black hole, producing a relativistic jet. And there, I will try to convince you that we know the answer regarding the composition of the jet. Okay? And maybe the same thing is operating also for GRBs. So that is to come on Thursday. I should say this is slide number 17 in case you are keeping track of that. Let's move on. Fermi. One of the goals of Fermi that was launched in 2008, so almost 10 years ago, was to solve the following mystery regarding gamma ray burst. How are gamma rays produced? And it had surprising result. What it found, it had a number of different instruments, a lower energy gamma ray instrument going out to about 20 MeV, and then a high energy gamma ray instrument called LAT, LAT, which is sensitive from about 20 MeV, but realistically from 50 MeV out to several GeV. And what it found is the following, that emissions were seen certainly extending to GeV band. Okay? That was not something that Swift was designed to do. It only went up to 150 kilo electron volts. It saw that, but that's not the point. The point here is the following. These different panels are showing you the emission coming out as a function of time in different energy bands. This one, top one, is the lowest energy band. The bottom one is the highest energy band, greater than GeV band. And what I want to draw your attention to are these vertical lines showing that the emission in the higher energy photon lags. There is a lag between lower energy and the higher energy photon. And that is something on the order of a few seconds. That's one thing. The second thing is that the higher energy emission lasts for much longer than the lower energy emission. And when I say lower energy emission from now on, I'm referring to MeV and less. And when I say high energy, it means 50 MeV and more. So 50 MeV and more last for about 1,000 seconds or several thousand seconds, and the lower energy ones for typically few seconds, 10 seconds, 20 seconds, that's it. So huge big difference. Again, completely surprising. You see, whenever there is a new technology, you are surprised. You find something surprising in addition to finding things that you expected. This is showing just an example, one of the cases, of the burst detected by Fermi. This is a beautiful burst. Again, you know, beauty, you know, is in the eye of the beholder. So to me, it looks beautiful. To you, it may look very ugly, I cannot say. But the point here I want to draw your attention to is that you see, this is the highest energy photon. This is the light curve lasting in this case for several hours. And you can see photons of 10 keV, you see how they are falling off? How you see this thing is falling off? Lockstep, exactly the same behavior. They are falling exactly alike. In fact, you can go continue up to optical, UVOT, same behavior, and so on. So as when I said that it's beautiful, that's what I meant. You have got from gamma ray, high energy gamma rays to optical, the same behavior. Quite remarkably the same behavior. So what's going on? The story, I'm going to tell you this story and skip all of those things. It turns out that Fermi's goal was to answer the question of MeV photons, how MeV photons are produced. The bottom line is, we have no answer. We do not know. As I speak, that remains an open question. So those of you who are young and starting your graduate career or young postdocs, there is a challenge there, one of the several challenges. You can go out and solve that problem. GeV we know. It turns out that GeV we understand. And that is something that is a nice story. Again, I'm going to rush through that story. But it's a nice story. It's one of those things where there are only a few times in the life of a scientist where you have a eureka moment. And that was one of the eureka moments that we had in 2009. I very distinctly remember with my graduate student that particular eureka moment. Again, this is not the time for storytelling. I'm just going to stick with the hardcore science, okay, and tell you what's going on. This technical thing, I'm just going to just not worry about it. Going to have to just go over. And you can always ask me questions. The point is the following, that the synchrotron radiation above a certain frequency has a property which becomes very simple. It doesn't care about the density of the interstellar medium. It almost doesn't care about the amplification of the magnetic field. All it needs is a weak magnetic field. So long as even there is a weak magnetic field, the synchrotron radiation would be produced, and the flux that it will be producing is going to be quite independent of the number of particles you have got and the strength of the magnetic field. That's all. That particular technical slide was a proof of that. Proof of that particular result. That, again, something that I had realized in a different Eureka moment in 2000, that that's the property, and predicted that that is something that should happen. And when the Swift was launched, quickly, the Swift team found this result, and there was a struggle. There really was literally many, many different teams were trying to figure out what's going on. And things came together rapidly for us. Within a matter of days, we looked through all kinds of model, all kinds of possibilities that I outlined on previous two full slides. There were all class of models, and we quickly realized that it is about as simple as it gets. And it went back to the prediction of mine in 2000, and what we realized is, if we compare Fermi data with the prediction, and here is it, here is the column here. This is the prediction. This is what Fermi saw. Observe. And you can see agreement, but look, if this is astrophysics with some uncertainty, but within a factor of 2, there is an agreement for these bars. And now there is a much larger sample. And this thing continues. So the bottom line is the following. We do not understand MEV radiation, but we do GEV radiation. We are quite far from equipartition. We are very far from equipartition between electrons and magnetic field, very, very far from that, by a factor of maybe a million or more. And even in the terms of proton and electron equipartition, we are not in equipartition. We are 10% of the energy of proton is in electrons. So.
Is that surprising?
No. The first one, yes. That the magnetic field is so weak, it does. The second one, no, because there was already a lot of evidence for that from the work that we had done in the past, that electrons have about 10% of the energy of the protons or the shock gas. So no surprise there. Yes. Right. So this is simply showing the data. This is the data. This is coming from the Fermi GBM, Gamma Ray Burst Monitor, that's what it stands for. This is LAT data. And now, this is the behavior that we predicted in 2000. And this is simply showing that this slope, this decay of the GEV emission is entirely consistent with that predicted slope, okay? But that's not a proof yet. The previous slide, I showed you the magnitude of the flux, which was in agreement. So it's not just the magnitude of the flux, but the time behavior are also in agreement, yeah? But that is not the end of the story. If this model is correct, we should be able to take the model. This is, after all, a shock wave which is moving into the surrounding medium, and then predict behavior at a later time. The same shock wave, as it is slowing down, is going to produce X-ray, optical, and so on, yeah? So you should be able to predict what that should be and compare it with the data. That's the strategy that we had. And what you see here is the prediction. Based on this, we could predict that this is where the X-ray should be. It is a, that is to say, the X-ray should lie within this band, optical should lie within this band, and I will show you what the data is. See, it's appearing, the data you can see for yourself. There is an agreement between the prediction and the observation. And I want to draw your attention to one particular thing. This is Fermi data lasting for 1,000 seconds, GeV. You are extrapolating that to 1 kilo electron volt. And 1 electron volt is the optical, or 2 electron volt. And the time-wise, you are extrapolating from 1,000 seconds to a million seconds. I just want to emphasize that this is non-trivial. You don't expect that to be just, you know, things where will come out to agree like that. So either there is a complete fluke, yeah, or there is something to it. Okay, I will just leave it at that. You can make your own decision. This thing can be done also in reverse, but I'm going to go through rapidly. Assume that there is no Fermi satellite. You only saw the optical and the X-ray at late time. You can make a prediction about the high energy emission at earlier time and then compare with, yes, Fermi exists, so you can compare. And so this is just going to quickly show you that based on the optical data and the X-ray data, you can go backward in time and predict what Fermi should see, and that's the prediction. And then now let's just overlay. And you can see it can go forward and backward. And so there is an agreement there. I'm just going to have to skip through much of it now and come to the point of answering one of the questions that was asked. And Professor Ray asked that question about the equipartition. And that is to do with this slide is to answer that question. This is the strength of the magnetic field, or more precisely, what fraction of the shock energy is in magnetic field. And this is showing you that the energy in the magnetic field is tiny compared to the energy in the shock plasma. Something on the order of 10 to the power 5 times smaller, or 10 to the power minus 6 times smaller. There is a degeneracy between the density of the surrounding medium and the strength of the magnetic field. That cannot be broken by the data that we have available. So all that we can do is have a two-dimensional parameter space consisting of density and the magnetic field. And the data, points that you see are points which are consistent with the Fermi data. Yeah? And those points are consistent with taking the interstellar magnetic field of strength about 5 to 10 microgauss, which is roughly what we have got in the interstellar medium, and compressing it by shock. No generation of magnetic field needed. And that was a long standing question in astrophysics. How are magnetic fields generated in shock? So in the case of gamma ray burst, it seems that you don't really need a dynamo at work. This is subsequently my students and I have looked at a wide variety of GRBs, arriving at a conclusion which is similar, that you don't need a strong dynamo to amplify interstellar magnetic field to produce the synchrotron radiation that we see during the afterglow phase. AF for amplification factor, the axis shows you amplification anywhere from order unity to in the most severe case 100, and the peak is something around 1.5. So you need to amplify field, but by a modest factor of 10 or so, as opposed to people were thinking previously that you need to amplify the magnetic field by a factor of 100,000. Sorry? It turns out to be completely independent of the Lorentz factor. This result is not dependent on the Lorentz factor, something that can be shown analytically. So I'm rapidly coming to the end of my time, and therefore rapidly coming to the end of the talk. We are now on to slide number 37, and I simply wanted to show you that this weak magnetic field, much below equipartition, is sufficient to produce GeV photons. And there is a limit. The limit is that the particles are accelerated when they cross the shock front by the Fermi process. And particles go back and forth, cross the shock front, and on each side they are kicked, and they gain energy by a factor of 2. And they keep doing this thing back and forth, and their energy increases. And that produces a power law spectrum for particles. What this slide is showing you is that the weak magnetic field is sufficient to give rise to the GeV photons we see. Moreover, there is also a limit to the highest energy photon that can be produced by the synchrotron process when electrons are accelerated by the Fermi process. So this slide, the bottom line is the following. One can show very straightforward, the concept is this, that the acceleration as it is happening, particles are also losing energy to the synchrotron radiation. Therefore, the loss of energy on a Larmor time, the shock crossing time, should not be larger than the gain of energy, which is a factor of 2. That's what it comes down to. Once you do this, once you equate the loss with the gain, you have an upper limit to the electron energy, which in turn gives you an upper limit to the synchrotron photon energy that you can produce, and that turns out to be, this is the expression. It's all dependent on the fundamental constants. Q, electron charge, electron mass, speed of light, and the only thing here is the Lorentz factor of the shock. That's it. And that turns out to be, you cannot, no matter what you do, you cannot produce photons of greater than 50 gamma MeV. That's the limit. Okay? But here's the trouble. The trouble is that there are several bursts seen by Fermi which have got photons, in one case, of 95 GeV. That's the highest energy photon from a gamma ray burst that Fermi has seen. And so that's mysterious. That's not so clear how such a high energy photon beating this fundamental limit that I mentioned to you can be produced. And we have some ideas that we have written about. That's the possibility. I'm not going to go into it. The other possibility is very straightforward. Inverse Compton. Take the synchrotron photon and scatter them to higher energy by electrons of even higher energy. And that can take care of it. Electrons. From the electrons. Yes, it's a good question. You could produce higher energy photons by hadrons, but the cross section for that is smaller by a factor of MP over ME, the ratio of the proton to electron squared. So that has got a 4 million times weaker process. And it turns out that energetically, you can rule it out. So this is the, I believe it's the second last or third last slide, so quickly approaching, but I did want to point out, and there is a reason behind that, and that is polarization measurement. This is of interest to a number of you here, and this is a table. You have the slides, so I'm not going to go over it, but during the prompt gamma ray phase, we have no firm case that everybody agrees that polarization has been measured. So you here in the audience may be the first ones using AstroSat to make a measurement of the polarization, and that truly would be a very substantial advancement of the field of the gamma ray burst and possibly other things too. Okay, so that's the purpose of this particular slide. And this, there is not anything that I can tell you that you don't know. That is to say, you can teach me about this thing, and I would be happy to have that conversation with you. Let me finish and summarize. This is a summary that we have learned many things about gamma ray bursts. More important, there are many problems, three in particular. They are fundamental problems that remain unanswered. Maybe some of you here in the room will be able to solve. My own view is that AstroSat could contribute, should be able to contribute to the polarization, and if so, it may be able to answer this, one of the big questions, this one here, of the MeV photon generation, okay? This really is absolutely the last slide, and I'm just going to leave it at that. Future prospects, you can read for yourself, but I stop here. Thank you for your patience. It is producing, but that radiation that it produces in MeV is much weaker, is a smaller flux than what is actually detected. So which means that there is an excess MeV above and beyond what this mechanism is producing.
I may be completely wrong on this particular
I doubt it. I doubt it. But go ahead. One class, which I didn't emphasize enough. The long, brush that last one more than 2 seconds are from core collapse.
Yeah.
The shorter ones are coming from
binary
system, which I didn't even mention much about. But yes.
Ones,
yes. Here is the thing. Here are the things that I know. Rather, we know. We as a community. It's not one case. I showed you one case, yes? But that's not the only case, yes? We have something on the order of a dozen cases where we see the association. In other words, we see a gamma ray burst, we see a supernova spectrum, yeah? So we see association. But that's 12 out of maybe 500 bars, yeah? So your question is a valid question. Could there be another mechanism, completely different mechanism, producing GRB, which has nothing to do with the core collapse, yeah? Unlikely. I will tell you why. Let me tell you why. And the reason is the following, that all of these long duration gamma ray bursts are found in star forming galaxies, every single one of them. So we know that this is property of youth, meaning young stars, as opposed to the short duration gamma ray bursts, where a fraction of them, something like 10 to 15% of them, are found in elliptical galaxies, which is to say in old population stars. Every single one of the long duration bursts is in star forming region. And it's the indirect effect. But I think it's a good evidence that we are dealing with young massive stars.
So in general, in community effects, it's gravitational collapse of massive stars.
But I have told you, that is to say, I've told you the evidence. This is some total of the evidence. And could there be something else? I'm not going to tell you that it is not possible that something else may not be going on.
No, but you have convinced.
That's right. Yes. I am aware of that. Please complete your thought and question. Go ahead. Well, I think there is a variety in both supernova and in gamma ray burst in regards to the amplification of the magnetic field. I think it's a subject on the supernova side is controversial, which by that I mean the following, that there was a claim that was made by Elliott Quartet and Thompson and so on, that maybe some supernovae remnants and the emission from there do not require any field of magnetic dynamo. That is a analysis and a claim that was made about 10 years ago. Now I know that people question that claim. There are some cases where there is a clear evidence for amplification. But in the supernova case, we are talking about amplification, which is, I don't think, is order 1,000. we are talking about amplification of the circumstellar field by the shock by a factor of maybe 10.
No, larger.
Is it larger? But is it a million? It is definitely not a million.
No, it's not a million, but you know, I think it's several thousand.
Is it several thousand? That is something we should talk more about. That is to say, we should talk more about, because I would want to, I want to be convinced that that is absolutely correct. Because what I have seen, I'm not, so let's, I would love to have a clearer understanding of that particular topic. And yes. Previous one? Sorry. Is this the one that you?
No. That flux versus time. Flux versus time.
Flux versus time. Ah, so that was the previous one. Let's go.
Go back. Ah, this one.
This is the one.
Dropping.
This is the one?
Everything is very straight, but GPM has a break.
The GPM doesn't have a break actually. Photon statistics. The Oh, GPM. GPM does have a break. That's the MEV. So you're looking at, the MEV is distinct. MEV is totally distinct. MEV emission is not coming from the mechanism as you were asking. So MEV is some fraction of the MEV emission photons are being produced by this external shock, but there is another mechanism which is producing lot more MEV than the shock is producing, this forward shock is producing. So much of MEV we see is different process.
Can we take questions from people from outside? We can continue this. Okay, please ask your question, maybe make it short in this one. Okay. Hello?
Hello.
Can you please ask your question?
Yeah. So the first question is that you initially mentioned that the matter will be electron or and the hadron part. Okay. So when you take the magnetic field is too low, so the magnetic field is too low and the electron, it can never tie up the hadron.
Right. So the coupling between the hadrons, which of course in this case really means protons, the coupling between the proton and electron, just by the Coulomb process, has a sufficiently short time scale compared to the dynamical time scale, and therefore protons and electrons are coupled, and yeah, so there is a transfer of energy from the protons to electrons in the shock.
That is the baryon poisoning, right?
That is the baryon, yeah, we could say poisoning, in the sense that, sure, it's there, yeah.
So it's becoming big. Do you have another quick question?
Difficult.
So we can read.
That's right. That's correct. There is a degeneracy here. And there is a degeneracy here between N and the magnetic field parameter, and that cannot be lifted with the available data that we have got. So the question really was regarding, I'm just going to repeat the question that was being asked, is that on one of the slides, and I could try to go back to that, I showed a 2D plot of N and magnetic field parameter, and we cannot, based on the data we have, we cannot determine N and B uniquely. All we can do is point out the region of this two-dimensional space that is allowed by the data, and that's a diagonal band. And so, yeah, any point within this diagonal band is certainly allowed by the data.
Now, since we'll postpone this question later on, so we'll wind up from here. Okay.
Like in case of Mishra shows, they have two inefficiency components. Like in some models, with this special model, we have this linear emission. From the synchrotron and photons, they get compromised in the dissipating region and it produces the linear emission. But you said that we don't have any region. But in Mishra shows, we also say that LED emission can come from there. But then here we say that they are inefficient.
So there are two, let's make sure to be clear about that. There are two distinct mechanisms which have almost nothing to do with each other. There is this photospheric process that you referred to, and that is taking place at a radius of 10 to the power 12 centimeter or something of that order, depends on the Lorentz factor of the jet. This process, this afterglow thing, is taking place at a radius of 10 to the power 16 or 10 to the power 17 centimeter. So certainly 4 to 5 orders of magnitude larger distance, and they are completely disconnected, completely disjoint. Yeah. So the GeV photons are being produced at this larger radius, and the 100 GeV photon or 95 GeV photon, that inverse Compton thing is taking place at that larger radius, not at the photosphere. And the MeV at the photosphere.
This question, for example, here at 10 seconds, your lag photon has a GPM. What makes you the lag comes are much larger size than the GPM?
Ah, so.
At the same time.
That is correct.
What makes you think that lag photons are order of magnitude larger distance than GPM photons? What is the
correct
argument?
That's right. So let's see, the simplest argument for that would be that first of all, the GBM ends. So GBM stays on in this particular case for a time scale of about, you know,
40 seconds.
About 40 seconds, and then takes a nosedive.
But lag starts in 5 seconds.
So that's right. And then continues on for 1,000 seconds.
So in the 5 second time scale,
correct,
what makes you think lag is coming much farther distance than GBM? At that time scale, 5 to 50 seconds.
The time itself doesn't completely determine the distance. And I'm trying to see if there is a good way to explain that. No. Let me come back to you and try to answer that question.
So your question?
So for GV, he told that
it comes much different distance.
Yes, from for MeV, what I am telling that in internet shows, you say that they are inefficient. But in some photospheric dissipation model, you have dissipation and then you have continuation and you produce the MeV photons. So what I was thinking that is there anything also that there is some drawback in some photospheric dissipating model, so that he said that we don't have this MeV emission.
No, not the GeV emission from there.
From there.
Yes, there is a drawback. The drawback there is this. The GeV photons produced at that smaller radius, they will turn into electron-positron pairs. The optical depth, meaning the probability of the GeV photons turning into pairs at a smaller radius, just because the density of photons is higher at smaller radius. So that's the probability is order unity at that radius. Whereas at 10 to the power 16 or 17 centimeter, the probability is not order unity, it's much smaller. So you can have the GeV photons produced at that radius and escape. So,
In case of JRB 1605-909A, if you have the photon like 52 GeV,
yes,
we have the spectrum which can be very well explained from the photospheric dissipation model. So in that case, we can have this high energy photon from the SSE, because there it is 52 GeV. So you told that in synchrotron external shock, yes, such a high energy is not possible. So in that case, if it is present, and then we should have SSE.
I think it's difficult to do this thing by the photospheric process. That lasts only for the duration that the central engine is active. And that we have information from the MeV photons. It tells us how long is the central engine active. And that's active for tens of seconds, not thousands of seconds. So it's very, very difficult, if not impossible, to keep the GeV photons being produced at the photosphere.
So this is about the X-ray flyers. So in those bursts, do we see GeV or we don't know about
those? Very good question. And to the best of my knowledge, we do not see a plateau in any of these cases where we have LAD. But that is to say, where we see the LAD data and we have the GeV photons. But that could be a small number statistic for in the following sense. The number of bursts that have been detected by LAD is a small minority. The energy threshold is sufficiently high for it meaning the burst to be picked up by LAD. So I am not going to tell you that they are mutually exclusive. So, but at the moment, the answer seems to be.
What do you mean by they? I mean, what are the two classes?
The two classes are burst with GeV photons detected by Fermi LAD and things with a plateau in the X-ray band. So the question that was asked, please correct me if I am mistaken your question. The question that was asked, I'm repeating it, is that are there cases where you see GeV photon, LAD detection, and the same burst showing a plateau in the X-ray? Am I right that that was the sense of the question? Yes? So
this one doesn't.
No, it's not just this one. It's not just this one. I'm telling you there is a sample of now for LAD burst something on the order of 15 burst. A small minority still, a small number of statistics. But I believe not a single one of them have the plateau in the X-ray. So.
In the list of very open burning problems that you have...
Three I have listed. To my mind, look, of course that's a biased sample. But in my mind, those are the biggest problems. Yes.
Don't you think the nature of the central engine,
yes,
what powers it and what turns it on, you know, hundreds of seconds later, like a flare and all that, isn't that one of the major problems?
Very much so. Completely agree with you. The nature of the central engine is very much so. And this issue of the flare, very, very much so. That is something I will address. I should have put on the list as certainly a burning problem, a very important problem. It's certainly been on my mind.
Can you be helped on that count?
Yes.
By supernovae which do not show gamma ray bursts, but nevertheless have relativistic expansion.
They could be orphan GRBs.
In fact, my own question, you know, which I asked was related
to that.
And the options such as you see a star falling into a black hole tidally being disrupted, so these are not sufficiently serious options at all.
I'm afraid not.
Okay.
But I don't want to just give an answer. I want to also tell you why the thinking is the way it is.
Mm.
And it is to do with the statistic. How many black holes are there? How many such events are to be expected? And that just doesn't work out. Just doesn't work out.
Okay.
There are too many GRBs to be accounted for by this particular process. So.
But how do you know how many black holes are there?
Well, we have some, we have got X-ray binaries with black holes. We have a estimate of neutron stars. How many neutron stars are there in the galaxy? So we have some senses. Do we know precisely to within a factor of 10%? Of course not. Do we know it to within a factor of a few? I would say, yeah, we do, to a factor of a few. And if the discrepancy is a factor of 100, then it doesn't matter. You don't know it to be within a factor of a few, right? If the case was close, yeah, that the statistics fall short by a factor of a few, then this becomes a viable possibility, no? Then you have to think then to go to the next step. Such an event, as suggested by Professor Joshi, you ask, can this event produce such an event, a star falling into a black hole? Can it produce anything looking like GRB? The answer is it cannot if the black hole is a supermassive black hole. That is something I will talk about on Thursday.
That is accepted, yeah.
Yeah. That is certainly.
But it is the question you was stellar mass black hole. So that's how I interpreted the question.
Yeah.
Totally. I mean, I didn't interpret it in a way that was not intended by you. I knew that that is where you were going. So it's a question of can 10 solar mass black hole, you know, have a star fall into it, and can that produce the time scale too long? Too long. Because it is determined by, after all, stars are fluffy object, 10 to the power 11 centimeter, and you can't just have them be accreted on a time scales of tens of seconds. White dwarf stars is a little better candidate, but even there you fall short.
So what is most interesting to me is rather than a static black hole, it is the dynamical collapse process that is playing some very important role.
But that is what's going on here,
yeah.
No? That is the scenario.
Why it has to be this phenomenon of jet only during the birth of black hole? Can this phenomenon happen later on? Is there any definitive answer for this?
Sorry? I mean, I didn't understand.
The process of GRBs, why should be accompanying the birth of a black hole? Can this process of GRB happen later on in the life of a black hole?
That is the question. That is the question.
Is there a definitive answer?
The later he rules out.
The reason it is being ruled out is that you have a black hole. You have a star. Take it to be a main sequence star. Let's start with a main sequence star because they are the most numerous objects that we have got. Yeah, a solar mass, roughly solar mass, main sequence star. The size of that is something on the order of 10 to the power 11 centimeter.
Okay.
Now you can ask, how long will it take for this thing to be accreted by the black hole? Answer is much too long.
Yeah. So, but it's a process by which the birth of a black hole gave rise to GRB.
Correct.
We don't have any idea of that process.
No, because it's a dynamical process.
Dynamical.
It's a dynamical process, so the time for collapse is the dynamical time, is the free fall time. Is the free fall time, and that time is something on the order of a few seconds.
Yeah.
That's why it works.
Ah, so
does that make sense?
Most interesting, yeah.
Yeah, does it make sense to you?
Yeah.
So that's what it is.
It sounds extremely interesting to me,
yeah.
And I wanted to come to that. Yeah.
So that's the reason.
Yeah.
So it's not, again, it's not.
Okay.
It's not my prejudice. It's not my prejudice against this thing.
Yeah,
possibility.
Yeah.
It's something that, you know,
exactly.
It's been considered
logically.
And yeah, logically, it flows through.
Last question.
Yeah. You said that the intergalactic magnetic field of few micrographs is enough.
Not intergalactic, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Interstellar.
Yeah, interstellar.
Or more precisely, I don't want to be nitpicky about
circumstellar.
Yeah,
okay.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yes. No. I wanted to just not make sure that I don't give you misleading information.
Yeah, that's true.
So,
I,
yes.
You are killing this point.
Yes.
Okay. So, the few micrographs is enough to compress and you can get this. Gamma, this high energy gamma rays like that. So if that is the case, every your gamma ray burst should get you the GV gamma rays, no?
Correct.
Okay. So are there cases within the field of view of LAT,
yes,
you miss any gamma ray burst?
People have looked for it.
Nearby GRBs.
Yes.
Which has been seen by GBM.
I totally understand your question. Oh, sorry.
Field of view of LAT.
Yes.
If you have
this, then
it is.
I think sensitivity issue.
No. So I'm not going to repeat the question because I think the question is sufficiently clear to everyone. So I'm just going to give you the answer. The answer is people have looked for it. There has been number of papers written on it. And here is the prediction. The prediction is that the luminosity and LAT, let's just call it GEV, is proportional to the energy in the burst, E, that is coming out, okay, and then times the fraction of this energy going into electrons is the product of the two. And therefore, there is a selection effect, because LAT has a threshold. Only above a certain threshold flux it can observe. See, the size of LAT is something on the order of about 10,000 centimeters squared. It's a little less than that by a factor of 2. Okay, so which means that it can only detect burst in the GEV if the GEV flux exceeds a certain value. And based on the work that people, it's not my work, it, other observers have done it, some theorists have also looked at it, and it seems consistent with that expectation. And that's the best I can tell you.
I think so. We should close this and maybe move on to the canteen and continue the discussion. Thank you very much for listening.